Good evening, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's David.
Hey, David.
I am a member in good standing of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had a drink today. I am also an active member of the home group Big Book in Ghent in Norfolk, Virginia. We meet on Tuesday nights at 5:30. We spend about half the meeting reading the Big Book and the other half sharing experience, strength, and hope on what we've read. We do all 164 pages, a third of the stories, and then we rotate back through it. I'm an active member of that home group. I have a sponsor. I work with other men in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm presently doing work with the treatment committee in Norfolk. I do a little bit with the corrections committee. And I'm chairing the group contact committee, which used to kind of sort of mean go out and get money from groups who aren't participating. And we're doing a little different twist on that. We're holding a new-to-service workshop once a month, and we're inviting people to come in, and we're just doing a little dog-and-pony show on the upside-down triangle and service opportunities in AA. And the idea being if we can get people to participate, then all the rest will kind of fall in line. I mention all of that not for you to say, gee, what a good guy he is. I can honestly tell you that I can look you in the eye and tell you that I'm active and engaged in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and in the service structure and with the program of recovery today. And I think it's no coincidence that I've never been busier in AA in my life, and I've never been happier in my life. And did I give you my sobriety date? October 24th, 1989. And I wish I could tell you that it has been a straight uphill curve of recovery between those two points in the last 22 years, but it looks really more like an EKG with a general upward trend. So I have, and we'll probably get into it, I have spent extended periods of sobriety in the last 22 years as well. So I'm going to take the temperature on the room. I don't feel confident in my joke telling enough not to tell you that I'm not to just tell a joke, but see, I'm telling you that I'm going to tell you a joke. So this, and it's a little crass, but I hope you'll tolerate me. But old fella goes and has his annual physical, and everything checks out. And at the end of the physical, the doctor says, you know, for a man of your age, you're really in excellent shape. Do you have any questions for me? And the fellow says, yeah, doc, it's really been bugging me. I am plagued with these episodes, these silent, these silent odorless, that's the word I was looking for, silent odorless gas emissions. They happen multiple times throughout the day, but these silent odorless gas emissions are just with me. In fact, doc, since we've been having this exam, I've had three of these silent odorless gas emissions. Is there anything you can do to help me? And the doctor gets out his prescription pad, and he writes it and hands it to him and says, this is for your sinuses. Come back tomorrow. We'll check your hearing. That's why I need a sponsor. I suffer from something I can't diagnose. I don't know what's wrong with me. You know, I need help. So I was born at a very young age in 1961 in Arlington, Virginia. My father, my hero, I know I'm here to tell my story, but I like to tell this story because it's part of our family lore and it's kind of amusing, I think. Once again, I'm telegraphing a joke. My father led sort of a charmed life. He was kind of the captain of the football team, married the head cheerleader, went to Wake Forest on a football scholarship, played poker with Arnold Palmer while they were there before he was famous, and he was just a happy-go-lucky, made a lot of friends, very articulate man, he was my hero. He was also, I guess, a full-blown alcoholic. Wasn't a violent guy or anything like that, but he was a veterinarian, and he insisted on being called Doctor. I'm not going to say my last name because we're recording. But he insisted he would introduce himself as Dr. F. And even a little kid, that used to embarrass me. I'd be like, come on, you're a veterinarian. Stop. not to say anything disparaging about veterinarians. I don't mean that. But he was about 33 years old when I was about four, and he was able to pay cash for a brand new classic muscle car. He drove off the lot, a 1965 Chevelle Malibu SS, candy apple red with white rag top, and four speed. I mean, just a gnarly car. I know. Well, he had it about 2 weeks, and he lost control of it on the way home, and he went off the road, hit a guy wire to a telephone pole, snapped the guy wire, hit the telephone pole, snapped the telephone pole, knocked the power out, came down on the back end of the car. He tumbles out of it, banged up and bloody, and to me, he did a very alcoholic thing. He surveyed the situation and then went home. And so the police caught up with him and knocked on the door. And this is all hearsay. I was just a kid. But what I'm told happened was they knocked on the door, and my banged-up, bloody father answered the door. And they chat for a little while, and the police officer finally says, Dr. F., you realize we're going to have to give you a citation. And my father said in his best W.C. Fields voice, I wasn't aware they gave awards for this sort of thing. So they cuffed him. So those are my people. That's where I come from. And I couldn't wait to get started. I absolutely remember the first time I got drunk. Me and myself and three other boys, a little bit older in the neighborhood, we were told by the even older boys that if you took a shot of beer every minute, you'd get really, really drunk and you won't get sick. And so the 12-year-old version of me said, okay, that sounds right. I have no frame of reference. But so we take these 12 beers into what we called a fort. It was really just an abandoned tool shed that was painted psychedelic, and Gallo wine bottle with the candle wax dripping down. Anybody from that generation? So we're in there. We're smoking cherry cigars and digital clocks. Digital clocks back then weren't, they were actually mechanical numbers that would just go around like that. And so we poured these shots of beer. And then took them and then just stared at the clock. Smoking cherry cigars. And I remember thinking then, this isn't going to be enough to get me drunk. And I thought about that later. It was like, I've never been drunk in my life, but I'm already concerned about the supply. And then it did. It did. Alcohol did what it does for people like me. I was suddenly catapulted in. I had a spiritual experience right there. I was in the presence of my brothers. If somebody had kicked in the door with a shotgun, I would have stuck my chest out. You know, not for love of those guys, but just because I thought I would have thought I could take it. Go ahead. What do you got? That's what alcohol does for me. It makes me powerful and happy, content, hilarious. And by the end of the night, I had vomited, passed out. The older boys used my available ear. For some reason, mustard was involved. I don't remember that at the beginning of the night. I had an ear full of mustard and cigar ashes, and I felt terrible, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And that's really the short version of the next 15 years. You know, I drank to get drunk, often got sick, often didn't remember gaps in the evening. I didn't hear the term blackout until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought not remembering everything was drinking. I mean, that's just the way it is. It's normal to... You call up the last person you remember being with and say, you know, what happened after Jimmy jumped out the window? Oh, yeah. And strange and absurd things would happen to me. Now, something like that, it was relatively innocent, you know. As I got older, they got more absurd and they got more violent and they got more disturbing and more abhorrent to me. I'm not going to do a fifth step from the podium, but... That's really what happened for the next 15 years. I love drinking. I don't understand social drinking. I was listening to a guy talk the other day, and he said, you know, they got a pill, or they're thinking about coming out with some sort of a pill that can make you a social drinker. He said, why would you pay good money to have two drinks and go to bed? You know, if you could give me a pill that I could get absolutely ripped up out of my mind and nothing bad would happen and I wouldn't feel sick the next day, I'd pay good money for that. Because that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in getting tore up from the floor up, falling down, cat chasing, gutter crawling, falling down, wasted. And that's what I like to do. That's what drinking is to me. you know. So if I can't drink like that, I'm not interested in drinking. Now, I had no idea as a teenager that's a pretty good symptom for being an alcoholic. It's not the bridge, it's not the bent fenders, you know. You put a quart of alcoholic or a quart of vodka in any human being, strange things are going to ensue after that. Doesn't mean I'm an alcoholic. Just means that's the human experience of alcohol. My problem is, no matter how strange and absurd it gets, I'll find a way to do it again. I can't stop. So, essentially, that was my teenage years. I had some consequences, and all of it could be dismissed as boyish sort of teenage rambunctiousness. But the other thing is that, and I learned this in Alcoholics Anonymous, was I'm told that 1 out of 10 people suffer from alcoholism. 1 out of 10 people have this reaction to alcohol. I just assumed that everybody I was drinking with had the same reaction. When they start drinking, they get thirsty. You know, more is better. You know, but 9 out of 10 people don't react to alcohol. I promise you, I'll never know what that's like. You know, so I find the other 1 out of 10ers. The good news is that 1 out of 10 people on the planet leaves you with millions of people to drink with, you know, and I found them. You can tell people who alcohol is important to. You know, you ever go to a wedding or something where there's not much booze, and you can see an alcoholic kind of scoping it out. It's just beer and wine. Well, you got a ticket. What's going on? And if they give you two drink tickets, you know, what are you going to do? If I'm an alcoholic, I'm either going to give mine away because I'm not going to bother with two, or I'm going to start seeing it. Are you going to use all your tickets? Or we go out to the car or whatever for our supplies. So I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know that that's what alcoholism is. I don't know that once I start, I can't stop. I don't know once I stop, I got a mind that I'm carrying around that's going to come up with a good reason to get drunk. I have no idea what's wrong with me. I just do what I do. I found the other alcoholics, and we did what we did. By the time I was 19 years old, I'd been to 4 funerals of friends of mine. I mean, guys I was running with, people that I loved, cared about. None of their death certificates say untreated alcoholism. They say gun accident, motorcycle accident, car accident, suicide. But I was running with those guys. I know what we were doing. But that, I loved those guys. I grieved those guys, but that didn't affect me. That didn't have any direct effect on me. Well, you know, by this time now, I almost blew high school. You know, I stopped drinking for a period of time. Found out that I could make it to class, found out that I could concentrate, found out I could study. I healed up pretty quick, graduated honor roll, went to college on time, drank away that opportunity, started getting a job, figured out that nobody was going to bankroll my rock and roll lifestyle, you know, that I was going to have to go find a way, you know, find some place to show up every day. See, because I don't want much. I'm selfish. I want to do whatever I want to do whenever I feel like doing it. That's a problem if you don't have any dough. So, you know, you do the math. Oh, I better go get a job. They don't want me around college anymore. So I just start experiencing the consequences of drinking. Again, none of it is dramatic. I kind of wish I had a more swashbuckling story somewhere between I don't know, St. Francis and the Hell's Angel or something. You know, I mean, I see myself as some kind of poetic, tragic character, you know. But all I was doing was just trudging through active drinking. I still don't know what's wrong with me. Drugs are part of my story, too. My policy on drugs was yes. That's all I'm going to say about it. So, but it's a part of it in that one of my obsessions of the mind, the way that manifested with me and my alcoholism was, I'm going to find the right combo. I'm going to find the right mix of chemicals, days of the week, times of day that it's going to work. It's going to all, one day it's going to come together. I'm going to be able to pull it off like my old man. My dad was able to make a ton of money and a ton of friends. I mean, 3 failed marriages and estranged children to his credit. But he was able to get the dough to keep going, you know? And he was my hero. So I had run myself into the ground. I was living in a 1-bedroom apartment. I had a job, kind of hanging by a thread. It was a horrible job. They wanted you there at like 7 o'clock in the morning. That's it, you know? If you stay up all night, you can get there. You hit the no-go, no-go point about 3 a.m. It's like, you know, if I fall asleep, I might not make, might not wake up. I'll just stay up. I know I'm an alcoholic because one guy shared in the meeting the other night. He said, what I used to do at the go-no-go point about 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd go take a hot shower, and I'd put on a fresh suit, and I would drive to work, and I'd just pass out in the parking lot because I knew somebody would wake me up. And the reason I know I'm an alcoholic is I sat in the audience, and I was like, you know, that's a good idea. I didn't think of that. So I'm just trying to make it, and I would run for days at a time, and then crash really hard, and that was kind of my mode. This sort of periodic, you know, I would try to put the plug in the jug. But I would watch these Serenity Lodge commercials. I don't know if anybody's from the Tidewater area. It was a local treatment center, the heyday of the treatment center in the '80s, and there would be this guy in khaki pants and a button down shirt, and he was a good looking dude. And he was just sitting there and kind of loafers, maybe no socks, and he's like, you know, I lost my job, lost my family, lost my house, but I've still got my health. And then the voiceover guy would go, last year Bob started a whole new life at Serenity Lodge. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm thinking, that's what I'm looking for. A whole new life. And they're giving them away at Serenity Lodge. So I'd write down the number and then I would hide it from myself. I keep making deals with myself. If I still feel this way in the morning, if I can get straight 8 hours of sleep and I still feel this way, I'll call. But then I would come to and I would start to come up with all the reasons why quitting would be a bad idea, and I would just go about trying to make it. So I say all that to just say I got to the point where I had enough. I wanted out. I'm going to call them. I'm going to call them today. I'm going to do something about this. And so I called them. And the arrogance that lurks in the back of my mind, I really thought that when they picked up the phone, they would know me. You know, we've been waiting for you to call. Maybe they'd send a helicopter or a limousine or something. You know, I mean, really, it's me. You know, it took me this long to ask for help, but I'd seen my sister go through treatment. I went to visit her, and I don't know anything about recovery, but I remember going up there, and she was in the first 36 hours, and back then she was just absolutely swacked on Valium. She was just high and happy, and laughing and joking, and I looked around, and I was like, they let you watch TV? 28 days. It was like a hotel. I thought, this is a good deal, you know? So I was ready to check into the hotel, and I called them, and they just wanted to know what kind of insurance I had. I didn't have any. So I just went on like that. So I end up, 22 years old, I end up in the Norfolk Inebria Program, which was it was run by the city of Norfolk. It was a 72-hour detox facility. And non-medical detox, they would monitor you to see if you were, you know, going into any kind of distress. But if you were fine, then you were just there. You got 3 hots and a cot, and then people brought AA meetings in. This would have been, I was 22, so this would have been 1983. I show up in that place. My arms are black and blue from intravenous drug use. I am shaking. I am incoherent. I cannot combine 3 sentences in a row to convey an idea. I could grunt, I could mumble, you know, and this guy starts talking to me about AA. I'm like, I don't want AA. I don't want anything to do with AA. It's like religion or something. And he said, oh, you don't have to worry about that. He said, you can make anything your higher power. You could make a doorknob your higher power. And I remember sitting there in that condition, just very, very close to death, I think. And I thought, well, that's the craziest thing I ever heard. And so I just kind of shook, and I hung out there, and I played spades, and I smoked cigarettes with them. And they were mostly street drunks, people that were just coming in really to get a break from that. And we all had lots of stories to tell each other. And then there was an AA meeting. And I don't know what really happened. I really wish I could have a video of what actually happened in there. But in my mind, you know, I'm just a kid. And it didn't look like the attractive group of people that I see in front of me today. It looked like God's waiting room. these people were on oxygen, you know, some of them. It just was, and everybody's smoking back then. And if
you want what we have, Sonny,
you know, and I was like, I don't believe I do. I just need to cool off a little bit, and I'll be fine. And I did. I said, okay, I don't need what they got. And I started going to a therapist. And I started a new hobby. For $9.99, I got a 10-gallon aquarium set. I put all my energy into it. I just don't have enough things that are interesting to me. And within 6 months, I want to tell you that I had like 6 aquariums, breeder tanks, 55-gallon things, and you can't touch any of it. You know, get away from that. I mean, I'm just this poor woman that I was with. She couldn't walk across the room without me having something to say about the way she was walking across the room. I mean, I'm just an alcoholic who desperately needs, you know, I'm the kind of person that people would say, why don't you get drunk? Because you're a pain. You know, I just complained all the time, and I was just miserable, and nothing was right, and the sun is bright, but it's too bright, and it's nice out, but it's not nice enough, the humidity, for God's sakes, you know. So this is untreated, you know, what I know today to be just untreated alcoholism. I'm an alcoholic without a drink, without a solution. And I made it almost a year like that. And I was sitting in the therapist's office, and I don't know where he got his certificate, but I don't think it was in, I don't want to say anything bad about anybody. But I'm sitting across from there. What I know today is I was describing the obsession to drink. And I'm just telling him, look, man, it's been almost a year since I had a drink. I'm bringing the money home to mama. Boss is happy with me. Everything's, Friday night, I just want to go out and have a cup. What is wrong? I'm over 21. What's wrong with that? And it's funny what you remember, you know. People remember their first kiss, love, things like that. I remember my first drunk, and I remember sitting in this therapist's office. And he said to me these magic words. He said, that'll come later. I was like, later? It'll come later? He just basically planted in my mind what I'd been hoping all along was that somehow, someday, I was going to control and enjoy my drinking. Some set of circumstances would prevail in my life that it would be okay for me to get drunk on Friday night. That'll come later. Well, you know when later came? Like on the way home later. And that started, that was my first AA meeting, and I got sober when I was 28 years old. So for the next 6 years, I just was essentially periodic, you know. I was managing and controlling the situation, so I got rid of a bunch of the chemicals, pushed those aside. See, I'm doing fine. I'm doing all right. But I just wanted to drink all the time. And I would stop. And I would stop for significant periods, for months, weeks, days. And I was just miserable all the time. And I still had no idea what was wrong with me. So I'd pop into AA every once in a while. It started getting kind of popular in the 80s. You know, famous people were getting sober. It was starting to be kind of chic, you know. It's like, it's kind of cool to go to AA, you know. And I'd run into friends and peers everybody knows somebody who's, Bob, the AA's got Bob. So I would come to meetings. And I would come, if it was an 8 o'clock meeting, I would come at 8:02 and I would sit in the back. I might not even take a chair. I'd just kind of hang out and just kind of watch what was going on. And what I would do is confirm to myself that I didn't belong here. That's what I was doing. I would look for a way out. There was a guy at the podium, a guy named Johnny Garcia. I don't know if he's still sober or still alive. But in one of those phases, he was up there and he was looking very uncomfortable in a suit, and he had like 3 years, and he started talking about his first round of recovery, and these guys were going to meetings, they were sponsoring other people, they were active in home groups, and they had what they called your hit your bottom club, and there were four of them, and they would go bong it up all night long, smoke dope, and that got my attention. I was in the back room. I was like, well, perhaps they're flexible around here. And then he delivered the punchline. He said, of the four of us, I have 3 years sober, clean and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Two of them are dead. One of them's in penitentiary doing 15 years. And, you know, so I left again. So that was it. I would come and go. I would come in. I don't consider myself a chronic relapser because I never threw in with you guys. I never stuck around long enough to understand what was wrong with me or let anybody help me. I imagined that I would come in and I would hear something that I could use and go back out and continue to try to control and enjoy my drinking. I love that line in there, and it was pointed out to me that those two words are linked, control and enjoy. And if I think about it, it's like when I'm controlling my drinking, it's very unpleasant. It's not enjoyable at all. And when I'm enjoying my drinking, it's way out of control. That's how I like it. Way out of control. And when I was younger, that was like my idea of adventure. I kind of knew intuitively once I started, I wasn't going to stop. I didn't know where I was going to end up. That was my idea of fun, just rolling the roulette wheel. We might end up in Texas. Whee! Who cares? Not so funny when you're 25, 6, 7, 8, you know. So basically what happened to me, I remember coming back. I'd done several little dry spells, tried to stay sober. I remember in December of 1987, I surrendered to the disease properly. There's a part of me that has a lot of respect for people that have the guts to go to Skid Row. I just find that to be a strong commitment, you know. I'm not that tough, you know. But I had just finished a week down in Florida with my two greatest drinking buddies, my brother and my father. We met girls, and you know, I couldn't talk. My father could talk, though, you know, so he would kind of lure them in. And he had a big pot throwing money around, good time Charlie kind of. It was great. Well, I had a blast. And I'm on this plane, and I've got this double jack working, and I'm just kind of calming down. That's taking the edge off this hangover, this dreadful hangover that I had. And I remember thinking, you know what? It's too hard to stay sober. I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm going to stay drunk for the rest of my life. And I'd made a commitment. I'm not going to draw another sober breath. If I live 50 more years, if I live 50 more minutes, I don't care. I really don't. But I'm not going to try that white-knuckle, awful, lonely, miserable, I want to drink so bad, I've got to get out the door and get a drink, I just want to, you know, I mean, if you walked up to me in one of these periods of sobriety, be like, how you doing, Dad? I'm not drinking. That's how I'm doing. You know, just awful, miserable inside. And So I didn't make it 30 years. I made it 3 months, and I got my one and only DUI. That was one of the other reasons I didn't belong here, because I never got in any trouble. Most of my friends had 3 or 4 of them, you know. But I got my one and only DUI in Fairfax, Virginia, a place I had not intended on going from when I woke up that morning. And I'd had plenty. I didn't care. I didn't even try to talk my way out of it. The answer to the question, have you been drinking, sir, was absolutely. What took you so long? So the nice man kept my cigarettes lit, and you know, I mean, I'm in the back of the squad car, he kept the cigarettes lit for me. Thank you. You can take it now, you know. And I was nice to him, and here's another little alcoholic thing. I was really kind of disappointed that the blood results only came back 1.6. It's like, I can't brag about a 1.6. My friends are cranking 2.5s over there. That's not a story. Anyway, I went back to AA. Not because I wanted to get sober, but in March of 1989, I went back because I thought it would look good on a court record. And I was doing my normal mode. I came in at 8:05, but I screwed up. It was an 8:30 meeting. I don't recommend this if you don't want to get sober, because you know who you meet when you come 25 minutes before the meeting starts. You meet the people that care about the meeting, and they care about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they care about one another. I was just there trying to be cool. Like 4 guys in the room, and I'm like, maybe they won't see me. Desperately want to be cool. I just want to skate by unnoticed. Well, this one guy comes up and he says, what's your story? And I'm like, well, yeah, I had drinking. But I don't drink anymore. I've been a couple weeks now, and all that's, you know. Guy told me it would come later, and he just, the guy had the audacity to cut me off in the middle of my mumbling, and he said, well, the way this thing works, pal, is you get a home group, you get a sponsor, you make a commitment to sobriety one day at a time, and if you want to do that, I'll help you, but if you don't want to do that, don't waste my time. I thought, well, that's a little abrupt. Will you be my sponsor? He said, yeah, I'll be your sponsor. You're going to go to the meetings I go to. You willing to do that? I said, yeah, I am. I'll try. I'll do it. Whatever. My way's not doing so good. And I'd fallen in with this. I've never found a good way to describe this, but these guys were like fascist alcoholics. And the home group went all over the Tidewater community. They all went together to whatever meeting. They went to their home group. The women had one group, and the men had another group. And then there was an open meeting, and they all went to that. And then they would go out into the community together. And then on Saturday morning, if somebody needed their house painted or somebody was moving, the home group, they would come together and they'd paint. And this was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I just and the leader of the group wore a turtleneck and a blazer. That was his fashion statement. And all his sponsees did the same thing. And I thought that was weird. I'm not getting a turtleneck, but I'll go to the meeting. So I ran with those guys for 90 days, and they showed me AA. They showed me, going early to a meeting and setting up, staying after and helping to clean up, empty the ashtrays. What are you doing standing there? They kind of browbeat me a little bit, but they were in action. They had a sense of purpose and responsibility to one another and to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how they did it. And they dragged me with them, and I just got to witness all of that. And I stayed sober. Just turned 28 years old. I healed up pretty quickly, and I got to feeling pretty good. So I just called the man, and I said, I'm not going to be at home group this month. The Grateful Dead are playing down in North Carolina, and that's kind of what I do. So he said, you ain't been sober long enough for that. As far as I'm concerned, you'll be at home group. Click. Went to the phone. Well, that was just like the last straw as far as I was concerned. I tried AA. Now, who's he to tell me what to do? So I never had another drink since sometime in March 1989, but I went back into David's Anonymous, went back working my own program, which is a lonely place. Nobody comes to the meetings, I come up with a problem and discuss what I think about it. And what about recreational hallucinogens? Yeah, we can do that. And so I just kind of created my own little world there. And how that worked out for me was 6 months later, no drink, no solution. I don't want to drink anymore. This is the other thing. I did have a desperate desire not to drink anymore. I really don't want to drink anymore at this point. I'm tired of coming to in that condition. I'm tired of feeling that way. Just the shame and the guilt and the remorse and the absurd things that I was capable of saying and doing, or the violent things that I was capable of doing, the illegal, immoral, all of it. I was tired of it. I wanted desperately not to live that way. I didn't view myself that way. I really view myself as a conscientious, kind, decent person who cares about you. Well, I didn't know that all of you were just looking at me and what I was doing. Not what I intended to do. Just all you, your only record of me on the planet is what I do. And what I do can be destructive. Heartbreaking, painful, downright mean. But I don't see myself that way, and I got to keep coming too. God, man, oh man, I can't believe that. So I'm driving around Norfolk, and I don't want to drink. I don't want to go to AA. I don't want to live. And I don't throw that around lightly. I know suicide affects a lot of people, but I spent time driving around Norfolk scoping out buildings. I thought the Baton Arts and Letters building at the campus of ODU would be a good one, because it was like 8 stories, and ODU was my first failure in Norfolk. It was my one and only geographic. I moved from Arlington to Norfolk to go to school. I'm going back to school. I love a fresh start. I'm a king of the fresh start, a new beginning. It's all going to be different this time, and it never was. I thought that'd be a good place to go out. But, I guess 2 reasons I didn't go through with that. One, I'm a coward at heart, and same reason I don't have any tattoos. I'm dreadfully phobic of commitment of any kind. So it seemed like a relatively permanent solution for what could be a temporary problem. So all I know is I decided to go back to AA. Something told me just go back to AA. but don't go back to those fascists, you know. Find another. I knew how to find a meeting list. I knew where meetings were, and I went to a meeting. And I go to this meeting, and it is, thank you. You guys are so nice here. Everybody's so welcoming, and you guys all, I was nervous when I walked in. You guys talked me down and told me some stories and got me something to drink, and I stopped sweating before I got up here. Thank you. So I can remember walking across the parking lot and this bowling pin of a man. He looked like Benjamin Franklin. He was bald on top and this gray hair down and little spectacles, and he was round. And Walt Mainwaring was his name. And I saw him see me, and that disturbed me because now I can't continue my plan of just sliding in unnoticed. I have to talk to this guy. Hi, my name's Walt. David. Welcome, David. Come on in. And he did for me what you guys have always done for me. He just welcomed me. He just made me feel like it was okay for me to be there. When I didn't feel okay in my skin, when I didn't feel okay in the world, he brought me in. He showed me the coffee pot. He showed me the little metal chair, sat me down, patted me on the shoulder, and he said, "Don't worry, everything's going to be all right." And I was simultaneously relieved and resentful. I really needed someone to tell me everything was going to be all right. But I thought, you know, how do you know I'm not here to teach this class? You know? Talking down to me like that. This is what, you know, I brought here. Sorry. So I remember I'd had enough by then, and I didn't know what you were talking about. I still don't really understand alcoholism at this point. I really don't know what's wrong with me. I know, I don't even know if I want what you have. But I knew that I didn't want what I had. I really knew that. And I could no longer deny the people in the rooms were doing, there was something going on with them that I didn't have. And I remember sitting in that room that night, and I said, I'm going to do what these guys do. I'm going to try not to argue with it because I see myself as an atheist at this point. I spent a lot of hours on top of bar stools arguing against the reality of God, you know. But at the same time, kind of thinking, don't say that out loud because you might, you know, you might get smoked or something. So I'm confused, but I committed. I committed to Alcoholics Anonymous that night, and I started doing the things that you guys talked about. I was willing to get a sponsor. I made a commitment to a home group. And I just started going to AA. I started, you know, you guys encouraged me to go to more than two meetings a month. I was like, seems a little excessive, but all right. So I started going to a lot of meetings. And I find myself in this church basement with this beautiful old man named Ray D. And he would make the mistake of asking me how I was doing. I would tell him. The boss, the girlfriend, and you know what she did. And then he'd say stuff to me. He died with 37 years of sobriety. And he was just the most calm, most placid, gentle man I think I ever met in my life. But he would listen to my rantings and he would say, "Well, David, this program's all about change." And he'd walk away. I'd be like, "Give me something I can use." One of those times I'm talking to him and he says, and I'm just ranting about whatever it is I'm on about. And he says, "You know, they used to have blue laws on Sundays. And you couldn't buy any liquor. But if you needed liquor, you could go to the grocery store and you could get your 4-pack of Sterno and a loaf of Wonder Bread. And if you take about 6 slices of that Wonder Bread and you pour the Sterno down, and what drips out of the bottom gets you pretty drunk, and you won't get too sick." And he walked away. He'd been dead for like 10 years, and I was sitting at a traffic light. I was like, I think he was trying to tell me about alcoholism. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. But he was a sweet man. And I kept coming to him with the steps, and he kept coming to me with, "Well, you're working. You're doing step one by showing up, coming to believe something. If you got a little something that's bothering you, just bring it on out." And that was his idea of the inventory. That was all I knew. So that's what I did. He passed away. I got another sponsor, did a proper 4-step. I worked as hard as I could. And by now, I'm starting to feel good. I'm about a year and a half long, 29 years old. Skin's all clear. Boss is happy with me. I'm starting to get, you know, into the fellowship. I've dated and found out I could dance. Who knew bowling was so exciting? You know, with all these people, I just started having a good time. You know, and so I really think, you know, that the fellowship kept me sober long enough to find the program of Alcoholics Anonymous contained in the steps. So I worked as hard as I could around here. I'm glad I got time because I often run out of time. So one night I was at the podium. I looked down. I was absolutely appalled. I had 5 minutes left. I wasn't even out of high school yet. I was like, well, that's what 22 years of sobriety looks like. Thanks. So I came here and you guys found me and gave me a life. Everything, you know, I really found this to be true. The only thing worse for my recovery than calamity is prosperity. When things start going good, I start looking good to me. I start thinking, see what we did? And everything I ever wanted out of life came my way. See, I didn't come here with a lot of losses. I'd never accumulated anything in my life. I didn't have any money. I mean, I had a job that I could point to. That was about it, you know? There was no wife. There was no children. There was no plane. Where's my plane? I didn't have a plane. But this stuff starts coming my way. Pretty little wife comes along. She wants 3 kids. I want 3 kids. She likes chocolate ice cream. I like chocolate ice cream. It's God's will. So we got married, and we went off into the setting sun under the circle and the triangle. It was beautiful. Not really. Okay. Wife comes along. Kids come along. A business drops in my lap. And because Alcoholics Anonymous gave me the courage to say, yes, I'll try. That's it. Not through my own intelligence, not through my own building of something worthwhile. It just literally showed up in front of me. And I said, okay, I'll try. Now I got my own business. Checking account looks great. Mama. Baby. Sobriety lost its priority. You say a slip is sobriety loses its priority. Little by little. And it's not like I made a decision. I never disavowed my alcoholism. I never said, you know, maybe I can drink like a gentleman. I was done drinking. But the sponsor that I had passed away. Didn't really hurry up and hire a new one too quickly. Home group, they're a bunch of jerks anyway. You know, I got this going on now. And so I put all my energy into that. And little by slowly, New Year's Eve would come around. I'd be like, man, I think I only went to probably about 30 meetings last year. Maybe I should look at that. I'm the human power in my life. I'm my go-to guy. What do I think about this? Maybe I should look at that. New Year's Eve rolls around again. I bet I didn't go but 12 meetings last year. That's odd. And then I didn't go to any meetings last year. I still got friends on the program that I talk to all the time. They'd say stuff to me like, thought about going to any of those dumb, stupid meetings? Yeah, I'll get around to it. Just lost its priority. I was busy making money, raising a family, doing all the things that I had imagined I was here to do in the first place. So, fast forward, 15 years sober, 15 years dry, abstinent of alcohol. I had become so, I'm not going to take all the responsibility for this, but I've done enough inventory on it now that I was back to untreated alcoholism again. I'm hypercritical. My wife can't do anything right. She's not raising the kids right. When my kids would get a cold, I would get mad at her. Well, you don't get many fresh fruit, for God's sakes. It's terrible, isn't it? Business is failing. Mama's got a boyfriend. I'm being invited to leave a marriage. I don't feel so good. I don't want to drink. But I'm thinking about jumping off a building again. Untreated alcoholic. So my little moment, my little burning bush, you know, God's never passed me a note or anything, but my little burning bush came in the back of a minivan 3 o'clock in the morning while I was searching for evidence to use in a court of law against her. So you know my serenity level was like right up here. Jeez. And I find a half empty bottle of wine. That explains a lot. But the half-empty bottle of wine doesn't say, hey, drink me, you'll feel better. I didn't have a psychotic break. I didn't really hear the wine bottle talking. But the message that I got was, you're an alcoholic. What are you doing not in AA? Why are you not in AA? What are you doing? So we separate. I make the best of that situation. I buy a house down the street. I start going back to AA. And I start going back to AA to the places where I got sober. And it's a weird thing. You stay gone for a few years and you come back. There's 50 people in the room. You're going to know two of them. And you didn't like them very much in the first place. But they're the ones who stick. It's a very strange experience to walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous where you got sober. Nobody in there knows who you are. You can see exactly what's going on. It's like he's got 4 years sober. He thinks he runs the place. They're about to get married. You know, there's the guru of the group. You know, I mean, you can see it, but they don't know you. And you don't know them. Very strange. I picked up white chips at every meeting I went to for a week, and I didn't care if anybody thought I'd been drunk the day before. It didn't matter to me. Time and sobriety, I felt... It didn't matter. I didn't care. It doesn't matter. It's not about this. I picked up the white chips because I wanted to try this way of life one day at a time. And I've got to tell you, it's appalling how few people reached out to me after I picked up that white chip. But some of you did. Graham was one of them. So I still do what I know how to do in AA. I just come and I just bitch. So I'm doing that at Starbucks, and the man who saved my life, I'm sitting there, I want him to be my sponsor. It took me a while to pick out somebody who was worthy, you know what I mean? And I cut this guy out of the herd, and I was going to, you know, have him be my sponsor. And I'm giving him my tale of woe. And once again, he has the audacity to cut me off in the middle of it. He says, yeah, he's full of guys like you. You're suffering from untreated alcoholism. I was like, he said, you know, you have to get involved in a home group. You've got to, you know, go through these steps. You've got to reach out. And I said, I know. He said, I know you know, but you're not doing it. So he laid out a really simple program for me at that time. I'm 15 years sober. He said, you got a home group? And I kind of swelled up because I knew the right answer to that. I said, yes, I do. Big book and get. He said, what are you doing for him? Well, I show up most of the time. He said, I want you to be one of the people who makes that home group happen, whatever that means to you. Okay. He said, I want you to say some simple prayers. I want you to talk to three alcoholics every day. I want you to look for ways to be of service. You find yourself in your kitchen at home, look for ways to be of service. You find yourself at the job, look for ways to be of service. Find yourself in an AA meeting, look for ways to be of service. He said, and we're going to move quickly through these steps so we can get on with the business of helping other people because that's why we're here. And I'd never heard that before. I didn't get that message. I thought you guys were all here for me to make me feel better, help my sobriety, heal me up, and if I'm feeling pretty good, you're doing a good job. And if I don't feel good, I'm going to let you know. And not directly either. It'll be after the meeting, out on the side. Did you hear what she said? Can you believe that? You know. That simple idea, the whole reason that we're here, and Tom I says, this resonates with me, is people talk about the steps as if they're the work of AA. He said, what he believes, and what resonates with me is that the steps prepare us for the work of AA. The steps get us into a condition where we can be helpful to other people. And I can look at you in the eye and say that I am reasonably effective, at least available, to other people in my life. So that was a watershed moment right there. Now, that guy carried the message to me, and then he flaked out on me. You know, he couldn't keep his appointments with me. But he brought me that message. And it lit a fire in me. That's simple. He turned the lens around. We're here for each other. I'm embarrassed to just say that, but that I've been coming around for all this time, for years, and it never, that simple message never got through to me at all. But when you put it in your life in a meaningful way, you'll find out how beautiful it is and also how crazy you are. Like, just as an exercise, I showed up in front, by the way, my wife and I reconciled. That marriage is currently healed. We're all living under the same roof. I get to be the husband of the same woman now for 18 plus years with a nice little year and a half technical out. I get to be the father of three beautiful boys. I've never seen their daddy drunk. I get to participate in that family. But so I just took the suggestion. It was like every day I try to show up in front of her and say, how can I be helpful to you today? And it feels weird at first. It feels kind of like, you know, how can I be helpful to you? But but it gets more natural. And I found out she's got some very definite ideas about how I can be helpful to her. I just asked, how can I be helpful to you? Oh, God, it'd be great if you could do that. And there are all things I can do. On my way home, thank you. You're welcome. Who knew? And what happens to me with this nutty alcoholic computer up here, you know, good information in, hoo-hoo, garbage out. After about 30 days of doing that, I'm pretty proud of myself. See what I'm doing? How can I be helpful to you? Then after about 45 days, I'm chewing on the table legs. I ask her every day if I can be helpful to her. Does she ever ask me? I go right up onto the cross. I do and do and do for you people. You know. And I'm subject to that behavior in my home group. You know, I'm proud to tell you my home group does not need me to run. It really doesn't. It's fine without me. Sometimes I don't think so. So the sponsor that I work with today, it seems to be all he wants to talk to me about is the third step. He's heard three or four of my inventories. I get frustrated up here because there's a lot of fantastic things that have happened, and there's probably a linear way to tell you about it. I just haven't gotten there yet. And I personally have never been a fan of coming up and telling you how to work the steps or anything like that. You know what I mean? That's sponsorship. My experience is if I avail myself to sponsorship, participation in a home group, you know, coming early, staying late with a service mindset, talking to other alcoholics, doing AA with other people who are doing AA, that inventory is going to get written eventually. That fifth step is going to get written or done. And we're going to come up to the amends. I made the easy ones. I made the ones that would benefit me. I like to be welcome at the Thanksgiving table, you know. But for years, I had some out there that I wasn't willing to do. And I just wasn't willing to do it. That's all. And in a sort of a warped way, I wanted credit for wanting to do them. You know, so I would tell people about it. These unmade amends are killing me. I really want to know what it's like to make the amends one day. You know, all of them. I mean all of them. I mean thorough. I want to be painstaking. And my sponsor finally told me, said, I don't want to talk about that anymore, David. If you got one that's bugging you, go do it. If you're not willing to do it, pray for the willingness to do that. Otherwise, shut the up. And I said, well, everybody wants to be abrupt with me. So I am, I can't stand in front of you and tell you that the amends that are left are living amends. I have shown up in front of everybody. I have paid back everybody that I owe. It's the little things that get me today. You know, when I showed up in front of my mother, and it's not little. I'm sorry I said that. They're not little things at all. When you show up in front of people, and they don't get to hear you're sorry, they get to hear you were wrong. It's hard for me because I like to explain why you were really wrong. That's what caused me to behave this way. I found out. So I go in front of my mother. The one I love to tell is my father. The amends process that I went through with my father enabled us. He never confessed his sins to me. He never apologized for any of the things that we went through. But in my simple admission of the things that I had done to him, what he gave me from that experience was, let's just go for the good from here on out. And that became a contract. That became that simple idea. Let's go for the good from here on out. I sat on bar stools wishing that man dead. Hatred and vitriol. Every psychiatrist I ever showed up in front of wanted to talk about two things, my drinking and my relationship with my father. I was like, I drink whenever I want. My old man's a jerk. What else you got? After that amends process, he and I basically were best friends. He trusted me with his arrangements. He's been gone since 2004. I miss him every day. He was one of my dearest friends. It was just a beautiful thing. From a simple willingness to show up and admit my fault. When I showed up in front of my mother, I said, "My, I genuinely want to make this right." She said, "Honey, just return my phone calls." And being selfish and self-centered, I drove away. I was like, ha! Got away with that one. But that damn phone rings. And it's my mother. And I got a spiritual dilemma. I could be grateful that she's still alive and breathing in and out, and I could, you know, be loving to her. I need a 12-step program to return my mother's phone calls. But I got today to do that. So here we are, 10, 11, and 12. Some people, I hear people call them the maintenance steps. I'm not here to contradict that. But I was told that they were growth steps, that they were living steps, that they were really where the rubber meets the road on a day-to-day basis of how we're going to live our lives today. Trust God, clean house, help others. And obviously there's some very specific ideas of how I do that. Start my day throughout the day, when I retire at night. When I practice those things, amazing things follow. I'm grateful that it is a program of progress and not perfection. I'm grateful that I get to be a very flawed human being, you know, that I get to show up and not do this perfectly, that I get to tell you how imperfectly I do it, and you guys aren't going to throw me out. You might, but I don't think you're going to throw me out of here. You guys keep telling me to keep coming back. And somewhere along the way, I have absolutely no desire to take a drink. I'm not interested in taking a drink, even when bad stuff happens. That was the other thing. That was the other lie I had. If I got sober, then the world would just open up for me. Well, stuff I don't like happens all the time. Thank you for letting me share with you tonight.